The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of February 11th, 2019. On this week's show, we'll talk about all the moves and non-moves at the NBA trade deadline, as the Pelicans kept Anthony Davis and the Sixers moved on from number one pick Markelle Fultz. We'll also discuss the new movie High Flying Bird, a slice of life from Steven Soderbergh about an agent's wheelings and dealings during an NBA lockout. And finally, we'll assess the opening weekend of the Alliance of American Football, the latest entity to try to make spring football a thing. Stefan Fatsis is off this week. Sitting in for him is the great Gene Demby of NPR's Code Switch and of Philadelphia sports fandom.
You were too kind, but thank you, man.
Great to have you here. I'm excited to hear your thoughts on the process.
Oh, man. It's finally over. Yep.
The ending of said process. Also with us from our studio in Brooklyn is Vincent Cunningham of The New Yorker. Also great. More in New York than Gene and I. But what's up, man?
Nothing much. I'm happy to be here.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The big news at the NBA trade deadline was that the Lakers' attempt to pry Anthony Davis loose from the New Orleans Pelicans came to absolutely nothing, with the Pelicans reportedly turning down the Lakers' offer of essentially everyone on their whole team who is not LeBron James, plus a couple of draft picks in exchange for the 25-year-old unibrowed all-NBA power forward. Now, after Davis and his agent Rich Paul, who also happens to be LeBron's agent, failed to engineer a trade to LA, the Pelicans star player is extremely awkwardly back in uniform with the Pelicans. He played on Friday and Saturday after the NBA reportedly told the team they'd be fined $100,000 per game if they didn't put him on the court. Gene, even for the NBA, this is fabulous and awkward as a soap opera. And the funniest thing to me was Magic Johnson, the Lakers president, saying this weekend that the Pelicans weren't negotiating in good faith, which is pretty much exactly like when Trump shut down the government and Lindsey Graham said the Democrats weren't working in good faith.
Yeah, like Bron and his whole army like sort of sent all these subliminals. Like, I mean, they basically sabotaged the market so that Anthony Davis could go to no other team but the Lakers. And the Pelicans didn't want to play ball. It's funny you mentioned that Davis is back in uniform and it's very awkward, because it's actually much more interesting to watch what happens with the Lakers now, because all of those dudes were going to get traded. Literally all of them save LeBron were going to get traded. And now they have to figure out a way to make this work for the rest of the season.
Yeah, and that same press conference where he talked about the Pelicans operating in bad faith, I think we need to have a national conversation about the misuse of the phrase bad faith. Yep. But in that same press conference, Vincent, Magic Johnson was like, you're treating these players like babies. They're professionals. Like, this is how the business works.
Right. That's such an odd distortion. I mean, no, you're treating them like people who are under contract with you, you know? And what one of the weird things is like how quickly this has changed the sort of the conversation of freedom vis-a-vis trades and players under contract for like a literal year and a half. You know, after I think it's like the Deron Williams trade for me is always stands as the sort of totem of like, oh, wow, like this guy, they just traded him away because they knew he didn't want to be there. And that has, you know, changed over the years from an idiosyncratic decision made by one team to now being a sort of hard reality that if a player says he doesn't want to be there, it almost becomes this obligation. One of the things is like, well, the Pelicans can just, yeah, Paul George, right. Mm-hmm. It's like, actually, the owner can just decide not to do that. And now all of a sudden that's like understood as a front, but it's like, well, no, we don't want to do that right now. It's so interesting the way like these, sometimes these trends, which are really more notional than anything, like all of a sudden, like they just hit a hard wall of just like one person's decision.
The crowd reaction on Friday was so weird. So he gets booed at home in New Orleans in the pregame introductions. He gets booed when he touches the ball. And then actually, but when he shot and it went in, then the fans cheered.
That seems it's, like.
And I actually don't blame people for any of those reactions. It's all, it feels like kind of coherent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
To me.
Like they want their team to be good. They also want him to be the centerpiece of their team, the literal centerpiece of their team. And also he very much doesn't want to be there. It's interesting, right? I mean, because they are in this, find themselves in this weird situation now where he has also sort of, he's also made it clear that he doesn't want to go to a bunch of places. And so he sort of killed their leverage in a lot of ways too, which is also unprecedented to Vincent's point. Like he hasn't said, he hasn't just said, I don't want to be here. He's like, I don't want to be in any of these teams, but these, I think he named three teams originally. And then they were like, and the league sort of suggested that it'd be tampering if he only said, I want to go to these three teams.
Well, he also put in a bunch of fake teams.
That's
like
right.
Milwaukee, because there's no way Milwaukee is going to trade for him.
That's right.
And so it essentially seems like it's down to maybe the Lakers and the Knicks, which is basically what everybody thought it was before he came out with this list. But
why would he want to go to the Knicks though? I mean, like if you were leaving the Pelicans, right, to go to, if you want to compete for a championship, why would you go to the Knicks? That doesn't make any, it's not even a lateral move, right? It's like a
because it's a beautiful city with a rich history of not winning in basketball, but it's a great place. So Anthony, just don't mind.
That is also true of New Orleans. All those things are absolutely true in New Orleans as well.
I'm curious what you guys think of this idea now that Rich Paul, the agent, one of the most powerful people in the league, the way that this is talked about now is that Paul and Davis tried to execute this power play, mm-hmm. tried to force the Pelicans to deal him to the Lakers now because the Celtics can't bid until the summer. And then Brian Windhorst of ESPN was saying after the trade deadline, I couldn't believe how my phone blew up at 3 p.m. with people mocking Anthony Davis and Chris Paul, agents, other teams, league officials saying they really screwed up. Do you guys have the sense that Rich Paul overplayed his hand here? That I guess just, you know, how this whole thing played out? Does he come off looking kind of foolish?
Yeah, I think that in some way he does come off looking a little bad. It clearly didn't work out the way that he, and when I say he, Rich Paul, I really mean he, LeBron James, another part of this, thought that it would. But I think that we're in a stage of entities like this testing their power.
Yeah.
So in some ways it's a useful exercise still for them, I think, to say, you know, all right. I mean, this was a very idiosyncratic thing, like the Rose rule by which Davis couldn't go to Boston. There were so many little variables here that maybe this wasn't the perfect test case, but I think it was still fruitful as an exercise for the league to see what's possible for players, which seems to be LeBron's larger project, to like test the limits of what a player, an individual player, reasonably talented, can achieve.
And when you think
own.
About those little variables, that's how Durant got to Golden State, is because of the little, you know, the bump in the salary cap. Mm-hmm. Like these larger trends that are happening, you still need to have these kind of weird idiosyncratic tweaks or moments or things that aren't necessarily predictable to have things play out the way that they play out.
Right, and it might be a while before we see another like useful test case, you know, just because there are so few players of Anthony Davis's pedigree. I mean, I guess, you know, Kawhi Leonard's another, as so maybe a useful approximation, right?
And we actually, I think, thought that this was going to happen with Giannis, but the Bucks are the best team in the in the East this year. Mm-hmm. But you could have totally seen this happen with him if they hadn't. Like, what's going on with the Bucks now is what the Pelicans wanted to accomplish with Davis, and you see the extremely divergent paths those two franchises are going to take now.
I mean, it was interesting because before the trade, everyone was talking about it. Like, look, there hasn't been a player of this caliber, of this consequence, who might move. It might be the most consequential trade since, like, Jabbar got traded from the Bucks, like, literally 45 years ago, whatever that was. And there are all these, because it didn't happen, like, there's all these sort of cascading effects, right? Like, that it's been consequential because nothing happened, right? I mean, you end up wasting, the Lakers are basically going to waste a year of LeBron's, like, the last few years of his prime, right? I mean, because there's a good chance they might not make the playoffs this year, right? I mean, there's a really good chance they might not make the playoffs this year. And if Davis becomes available and wants to go to LA, that won't be for, that might not happen until he's, like, a legitimate free agent, which is the summer after next, right? And so LeBron
2020.
LeBron will be 35, 36, right? I mean,
well, that's why I think you get the sense of entitlement. Like, this isn't supposed to happen.
Right, that's right.
We want Anthony Davis. He needs to be here now because time is running out on LeBron. And I think the last thing before we move on to the Sixers is that there's this tension between large market teams and small market teams. And you feel like the Pelicans are, it makes sense for them to wait. I think it's not, they're not doing this just to troll the Lakers or anything.
But their future is like one of the big downstream consequences of him leaving if that happens.
But I think there is a sense that there's a bit of standing on principle and this idea that we're not small market teams like us. You know, Oklahoma City has gotten obviously pissed off about various things over the years that we're not going to let these teams bully us and let these players bully us. And that, I think, Vincent, is another scenario in which this is a test case, really.
I think that there is like a, there was that apocryphal story about, I'm not sure if it's true or not, that, you know, Greg Popovich had reached out to the Pelicans ownership and was like, don't let the Lakers bully you. And, you saw a little bit of that with Kawhi as well. There are these sort of individual stands that seem to be able to be made in certain situations. I don't know if that's Lakers specific, LeBron specific, but there is, I mean, I think that like the Pelicans were trolling the Lakers, but there does seem to have been some willfulness there that who knows if it would have been the same if it was in a different situation, but.
The Lakers lost to the Sixers on Sunday by a lot of points. It was 143 to 120. Mm. If the Lakers lost the trade deadline, then at least in the very near term, it seems like the Sixers won it. They were the big winners. They got Tobias Harris from the Clippers, giving them a ridiculously good starting five of Harris, Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, Jimmy Butler, and J.J. Redick. They also traded Markelle Fultz, the number one pick in the 2017 draft. He went to Orlando for forward Jonathan Simmons and some draft picks. Gene, this is obviously interesting given Fultz's story and how he lost the ability to shoot and the questions about whether it was a physical or mental issue. But it's also interesting because it signifies that the process is over in Philly. The franchise is done accumulating assets and it's going all in on winning now.
It's been interesting to watch this last, I guess, like 8 months of Sixers machinations, right? Because of this, the ambivalence that you can hear in Sixers fandom about the end of the process. I think there was one, people sort of romanticized it a lot, but also there's like now that people have to cash in their chips, now there's going to be a lot of second guessing about whether these are the chips. I mean, these are the deals they should be making.
And right. When you have assets, then
it's all theoretical. It's all hypothetical.
Now they have these literal basketball players.
They have actual basketball players, right? I mean, it's one of the, in a weird way, the Celtics are sort of in this perpetual, they're not in the process because they were never bad. They actually managed to rebuild without being like, without cratering, but they're always in this sort of perpetual cycle of like, we will have more picks and more picks and more picks. And now you have this, the Celtics have this team that is both like loaded, is like stacked from top to bottom, and also I think they have more picks that might be conferred to them. And it's like, at some point, it's like, y'all, like, chill. Like, it's enough. Like, you know, like, I mean, they're still making, like, we're going to flip these great pieces we have for better pieces. Like, what are we doing at some point? At some point, you just have to decide on what you want your living room to look like, right? You can't just keep swapping out the furniture. And, like, I think Fultz was one of the reasons he was, in particular, so romanticized was that he was a homegrown guy, right? He would have been. I mean, had he actually played more than like 500 minutes.
Do you have sadness about how that played out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that whole situation was, I mean, obviously you guys talked about it before, it's so bizarre. And it sort of underscored, I think, it reminded me of all the ways in which we as sports fans, as particularly basketball fans, what people are talked about in this very, like, sort of, like, these are widgets you plug in, right? About, like, how much of this is, like, these are, like, actual, in this case, like, teenagers we're talking about, right? People who are actually dealing with, I mean, Markel Fultz was not a heavily recruited dude. He, like, had this growth spurt. He went from, like, you know, a dude who might have been, like, a good mid-major player to, a number one pick in, like, the course of, like, you know, 36 months, right? And, like, the questions about, I mean, I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like to have this, like, level of scrutiny suddenly on you as you go through this sort of, this unprecedented sort of collapse of your basketball ability. You know, he wasn't built the way that a lot of the other, like, blue chippers were when they sort of grow up under the scrutiny, you know? And so, like, watching him, for the most part, like, by all accounts, he's, like, a really good dude. He's really, like, you know, like, really present and is a really good teammate. But watching him sort of have to navigate, like, have to be picked apart all the time and sort of psychoanalyzed by people who literally know nothing. We know nothing about still, like, what even the circumstances are, right? it just, like, reminded me of how much we often talk about these people just as, like, sort of machines and not as just, you know, I mean, 19-year-olds.
And, yeah.
You
know? Vincent, kind of the strangeness here is that a couple years ago, if Fultz had been drafted in 2015 instead of 2017, the Sixers would have been the perfect franchise for him because they were just running out the clock for all these years. They took Embiid and Saric, right, too, and didn't even want them to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could have figured things out in that kind of obscurity that we're talking about that he'll now find in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
And then their timeline totally changed and he just wasn't, they didn't have the ability or interest to wait for him anymore now that they have Jimmy Butler and they're in this mode where they need to start winning the East, mm-hmm. you know, this year.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. There's just he came along at this moment and like we talk about the end of the process. Who knows if we would still be thinking of them in this like future oriented way if it were, you know, right now, if they had Fultz and let's say they hadn't done this Tobias Harris deal or whatever, you know, maybe we'd, for example, if they get kicked out of the second round this year, I think it will be understood sort of catastrophically. It will be for me because I love watching them, by the way, but
absolutely, it would be a disaster.
Yeah. But if it was, yeah, it'd be terrible. But if he, if he were still there, I think maybe our expectations would be along some other line. But yeah, it was awful timing. I mean, Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid are too good to be in that other mode. They're too good. And if next to them you have a guy who like clearly there's something, you know, something happening. It just gets really, it's just dark, you know? So I'm wishing him the best. I have a lot staked in him getting better. You know, I want to believe that it's possible for him, for whatever it is that's been ailing him, to get better. So I'll be watching him in Orlando.
It's so crazy how the East just got so interesting so fast after mm-hmm. being
the dreg.
Such a cesspool for so long. I mean, the Raptors got Marc Gasol mm-hmm. at the deadline. The Bucks got Nikola Mirotic. And as I said before, the Bucks, in terms of point differential, in terms of record, they have an argument to be actually the best team in the NBA. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have a second round if things go according to form, and it's hard to see how it won't, at least in the first round, where you'll have the Raptors, Bucks, Celtics, and Sixers. Two of them aren't going to get to the finals. It's going to have massive implications for free agency. Yeah. Like, did this catch you by surprise that the East all of a sudden became like the more interesting conference?
One of the things that's been fascinating about the sort of asymmetry of power in the NBA has been why the East is so bad. Like, it's been impossible to figure out exactly why, like, what, like, sequence of events led to the East being this like anemic conference where none of the superstars really played, absent LeBron, like none of the top flight players, and all the top 10 players have been in the West. And that's not just drafting, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons why that keeps happening. Maybe they just like better administer teams in the Western Conference or whatever. But it's fascinating that all of those things is sort of like reversed in 8 months. Like all of the sort of the decade and a half of momentum towards the West being, I mean, to the point where we were like, we can't have East and West All-Star teams. We can't even have an Eastern Conference, Western Conference, like a playoff tournament organized around a conference because the East was so bad, to suddenly having a situation where the East might have like four of the six best teams in the league.
Well, to answer your previous question, the reason the East is so bad is the Knicks. Everything is the Knicks' fault. The Bulls a little bit, but those are, you know, two franchises that deserve some blame. But Vincent, I guess last thought on this is that it's not only feels odd that the East is good and interesting, but just for the modern NBA, it feels odd and and amazing that you're going to have hopefully these Eastern Conference semifinal series where all the teams and fan bases have the reasonable expectation that they're going to win, and it would be reasonable for all of them to be disappointed if they lose. Like, this kind of level of parity and uncertainty going into the playoffs is like, thank God.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You go team by team. I think the biggest catastrophes potentially would be the Celtics and the Raptors, because it has so much to do with their fates as organizations. Mm-hmm. You know, like Kyrie Irving seems ready to book a flight today, and nobody can quite divine what Kawhi Leonard is ever thinking. And so you just like it just seems to matter so much that they do well. I mean, again, I'm a Knicks fan, which means I look for other teams, and like the team that I like to watch is the Sixers. So like, I want them to go as far as possible because I don't want to imagine life without Ben Simmons. Some of those teams will just, you know, it'll be really, really tough for them. But then you think about, you know, I say that about the Sixers, but you never know. Like all this timing stuff, how everything has sped up. It's like all of a sudden I'm now aware, more aware than I have been, you know, in past years, that Ben Simmons is also a clutch client. And does he want to go and like hang out in Southern California? It's like everything is happening so fast. I know, Gene, I'm sorry.
We gotta end
this
segment before.
Finish
your thought.
Sorry. I don't want to hurt anybody. And listen, I want him to be in Philly because I plan to take the Amtrak and watch him sometime.
He's amazing in real life.
It's just, you know, everything seems to be so staked on the moment that, like, sure, Giannis is happy that team is good, but what happens if he like just, I mean, the fact that we're talking about Kevin Durant leaving potentially, and I guess we'll talk about that later, but it's like, It doesn't matter now that the team is good necessarily. Like, the person could just decide they want to do something else.
That's what happened with Kawhi, right? It was like, even Paul George, right? It's not feeling it. I want to do something else in my life.
Right. I want to go play with my friends, or I want a new challenge or whatever. So I think this is a great opportunity to just like watch the games, which is my contention with, you know, the NBA now, where it's like, we're always thinking about the future, but these Eastern playoffs are going to be a great time to just like watch the games and enjoy basketball and see like great players play against other players. I'm really stoked for it.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we get to our conversation about High Flying Bird, wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, Vincent and I will discuss Kevin Durant. Oh, poor Kevin Durant. There are rumors about him going to the Knicks. He did not respond well. Sympathy. Should we be sympathetic? Not sympathetic. We'll discuss. To hear that conversation, join Slate Plus. It's just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. In his review, my colleague Dan Coyce called Steven Soderbergh's new film, High Flying Bird, a kind of workplace heist movie with insurgent undertones. The movie, which just premiered on Netflix, is about basketball and features almost no basketball at all. It takes place during the middle of a long NBA lockout, and it starts with a 5-minute conversation between agent Ray Burke, who is played by Andre Holland, who you might know from Moonlight, and his client, a first-round pick named Eric Scott. He is played by Melvin Gregg of American Vandal. Let's listen to a little bit of that conversation.
See, he heard about the trouble. Meetings happening and no resolution. Everybody expecting something to come down to the wire like it always does, and the owners or the players to fold. But if they didn't, wonder how people are going to survive. Then he scared you, describing how a lockout doesn't affect the Stephs and the Durants. They got that long money. It's going to take a minute before it affects their daily life. But those check-to-check fellas, the ones just starting out, the rookies?
He said, use the term freshman.
Mm-hmm. He saw you panicking and he offered you some dumb interest loan from his bank. At that moment, you should have asked yourself, what's his angle? Why is he being so damn generous to me? And then you should have said, hey, man, I'm doing all right, you know? My agent, who also isn't being paid during the lockout, by the way, told me don't take a loan unless I can pay for it. At which point I would have said, I, being you in this case,
said that's stupid.
That's right, Eric. You said that's stupid.
Vincent, a high-flying bird, teaches us some important lessons about loan sharks. and the avoidance of them.
Exactly.
It's about sports and race and business, and very self-consciously. So what did you make of the movie?
I liked it. There are certain threads that I'm still trying to tug at to try to, there are some certain things that I'm not sure that I liked about it or I thought cohered, but I thought it was awesome. Terrell Alvin McCraney, you mentioned Moonlight, the guy who wrote the play on which Moonlight, the movie, is based. Terrell Alvin McCraney, he wrote this movie, he wrote the screenplay. And it's just, it's wonderfully written, great dialogue, I thought, a great sort of musical pace that kind of fits with the kind of whimsical way in which it's filmed, largely on iPhones, by the way, which is pretty cool. Yeah, when you like, there are certain angles when you just like see it's the exact aspect ratio of an iPhone, and it's just kind of like, oh wow, I don't know, it was a kind of a nice touch. But there are lots of threads about sort of how athletes go about their lives. Like the Ray character has a he's kind of haunted, or people keep mentioning his cousin Gavin, who didn't work out in the NBA for reasons that I guess should be left unspoiled. But, you know, trying to reconcile that with the Eric plotline, and I was trying to figure some of that stuff out. I wasn't sure if it totally all worked together, but I thought an awesome movie about what's increasingly important in sports generally and the NBA specifically. So I was into it. I watched it once and a half. I watched the second half of it again this morning because it was just kind of fun.
Yeah, there was the thing about the way his cousin didn't work out that you want to leave unspoiled. Almost could have been a movie unto itself, right? It was said in passing. And it was like, oh, that's an interesting. That was not where I thought that was going to come.
That's a whole other thing.
And I think that's one of the things the movie has going forward is that there's a ton of ideas in it. And in the corners and the crevices of the movie, there are all these sort of really interesting things being raised. But almost like too many ideas in some cases. Like you almost want a lot of them to have more breathing room. And I think just the notion of setting it during a lockout is really fascinating. I'm surprised we haven't seen that done before because sports lockouts tend to be the times in which like all of the labor and race dynamics of professional sports become the most, like they become foregrounded, right?
This movie has come out at a very fortuitous time given that we just, you know, passed the NBA trade deadline with all of the conversation we just had about player agency and player movement, but also the government shutdown and this notion of a powerful and unfeeling entity not particularly caring if people get their checks and kind of the way that happens and the way that it's resolved. And I was a little bit heartened to hear you guys both kind of allude to the fact that there are some threads in this movie that aren't quite resolved, because I am generally the guy in the movie who like has to lean over and ask like, what the hell just happened? What's going on here? And I found this movie like pretty confusing. Mm-hmm. There were parts that were hard to follow. There were things that get mentioned in the beginning that don't get resolved by the end. But I think, you know, I'm feeling pretty generous towards it. I think it is a movie of ideas, like you said, Gene, and these are ideas that I feel grateful are like out in the world. You know, we've seen more movies about the business side of sports I had actually forgotten that Steven Soderbergh was going to direct Moneyball.
Oh, wow.
Until Bennett Miller eventually took it over. But you kind of get the sense of like this is Steven Soderbergh's like redo or like opportunity to take that on. But we haven't really seen a movie, Vincent, about the business side of sports from kind of a pro labor perspective, or that actually that takes on questions of race. Like, this is not Draft Day starring Kevin
Costner. Or Jerry Maguire.
Or Jerry Maguire, yeah.
Right. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, good point, yeah. It's interesting because it is totally, right, pro-labor, very aware of race in its politics. But I think what's really interesting about that is that it situates all of that in the person of Ray, who is this middleman, essentially, right? And we kind of think, we forget, except in the actual NBA where it has suddenly become foregrounded with Clutch, we forget that there are all of these entities that skirt the line between ownership and labor, these agents and managers and people who are interested in the money that the players make by the definition of their roles, but also care about them and want them to make as much money as they can. So they're kind of always in touch with the player, but also kind of a little bit closer to the league than is maybe always in the player's interest. And there are moments there in the movie where that is foregrounded, right? Where the player kind of pointedly says, oh, but you stand to make money from this decision or this thing, you know? And that was really interesting to me just because I still don't understand what's up with Clutch. I don't see how it's legal.
How is Clutch legal? It's one of the weirdest things.
It doesn't make any sense.
So crazy.
Yeah. And I think that as soon as I have no clue how it's legal. And my suspicion, I guess, is that at some point, probably after LeBron's departure, the league will find a way to legislate this fuzzy thing out of existence, the best friend-owned sports agency. But it was really great to see in dramatic fashion that person, you know, kind of in the middle on this border between ownership and the league and the player, that person be foregrounded and have some flesh put on that character. I really enjoyed that part of it.
So I appreciate the fact that you don't want to spoil the movie for the people, but there are a couple of things I wanted to talk about that I think it's fine if you listen to this before you watch the movie. But if you really want to be totally unspoiled, then plug your ears for a few minutes. The first is that it's always nice when a movie doesn't screw up social media so badly. And I felt like the way that the kind of one of the central moments in the movie is this social media beef between Eric and the rival player on his own team. They're both coming into the league, and it leads up to this kind of confrontation, this one-on-one moment. I was wondering if you thought, Gene, that the way that played out was realistic or kind of it does capture the sense in which so much of our interest in the game as fans sort of does play out on social media now.
I thought it was like the most, in a lot of ways, like the most plausible part of the movie, right? I thought they actually did a really good job of recreating the scene. The way it would play out was like, oh, here's this video of these two guys going at it on some random basketball court somewhere in the Bronx. And all the kids' reaction, I think the kids' reaction was like a thing that sold me on it. Okay, that's exactly what would happen, right? Everyone, all the kids going like, oh, and it is, I mean, basketball, maybe more than any other sport, has become a sport that is consumed almost like through like, I mean, Vincent sort of alluded to this before, but like so much of the way we consume basketball content is like unrelated to the actual basketball itself now. I mean, it's like we follow the Twitter streams, the timelines of like stars and the way they subtweeted each other. And I mean, all of that, it seemed completely legitimate. I sort of didn't quite buy the monetization part of it. Like, I don't know if
definitely did not buy that.
Yeah. Like, I was like, I don't know how this part holds together, but I thought that the actual execution of that part of it, the literal, like, you know, this video, if that video happens, if like, if KD and Russell Westbrook were like playing ball UCLA, I mean, even if and I'm sure they have, like, doing some UCLA run of the summer, it would be like scrutinized. It would be one of those things that it would be like the Zapruder film, and people are like, oh, how are they? Where is their body language in relation to each other? And like, you know, I mean, right now, I mean, we do this every summer. Is like we see all these workout videos in which you see some run with like, LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony and Russell Westbrook, we're just playing ball at the Y together, and it's like, man, like, and just like there's all this, and it just, and those videos get crazy views. It's like all these things, and you're like, you're trying to read the subtext, you're like, wait, what? So Bron and KD are hanging out in the summer playing ball, like, what is this about? Like, yeah, it's just weird. And well, that seems completely plausible.
This is one of the central questions of the movie, and we'll get into this a little bit in our next segment too about this upstart football league, is that does the superstructure of the NBA, do the team names, do the history, does fandom around the teams, how much does that matter? Or could we imagine an alternate universe in which you strip all that stuff away and you just have the players? And I think that, you know, we don't get necessarily an answer in the movie, but I don't think that, to your point, Gene, I don't think people would pay to watch guys play in Vegas, like an exhibition game like that. That to me is totally implausible.
Right. That's right.
And to speak of, you know, the labor angle too, is that like, maybe you would, if like Gene says, it was in fact Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, but you go down one level, right? If it's Tobias Harris and whoever, you know, it's like
Chris Middleton.
And Chris Middleton. Precisely right. It just like, immediately, I'm not going to watch that. And so I think there is a sense in which, and I think this also goes back to our thing about these blockbuster trades, right? There is a sense in which there is a much greater freedom for about 25 to 30 guys. But then there are 450 people in the league.
And those guys get thrown into the trades to make the money match for the big guys.
And it's their lives just as much as anybody else's. So, I mean, that's the thing. The larger structures do tend to protect those people. So it's, you know, everything mixed.
One thing I want to ask you guys is I got sort of Spike Lee vibes from this movie a little bit. There were sort of these weird characterizations. Yeah. The very involved, very churchy mother / agent. And you know, Bill Duke's character with that like a little refrain, like, I love God and all these black people. Those felt like very spiky touches to me. They felt more...
And so did those interviews with the real players, by the way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I totally got that, yeah.
I was actually surprised. I was like, you didn't see the dolly shot, so you knew it wasn't a Spike movie, but there were parts of it. And also, like, I think that the dialogue didn't sound like, you know, Spike has that 60-year-old curmudgeon thing happens. Like, no one talks like this.
Right.
And so the dialogue sounded much more on point than that. But there were moments of in which people were sort of stating very explicitly their reason, their life motivations, which is like a very spiky thing, you know?
Yeah. It was not subtle. I was also a little confused about why Carl Anthony Towns wasn't looking into the camera.
Yeah, it was
like, where are you looking? Like, why are you looking into the sky?
And he's 7 feet tall, so even if he was sitting down, you still had to be pretty, the camera had to be pretty high up.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, the last thing I wanted to ask you guys about, and this is also a spoiler, but the book Revolt of the Black Athlete by Harry Edwards takes on this kind of totemic importance. Gene, you were wondering on Twitter how one could read that whole book while during the duration of a shower, which is an interesting question. But curious what you guys thought about...
you need to read this like I just did.
Curious what you guys thought about the role that book played, that Harry Edwards played. Just full disclosure, I have not read The Revolt of the Black Athlete. I'm familiar with Harry Edwards' work. Mm-hmm. Vincent, you wanna go? What did you think about the way that the role that it plays in the film?
I thought it was interesting because it sort of did an unraveling of the movie in reverse. Like, it's the very last thing that happens, and you can kind of to Gene's point about, you know, the movie being full of ideas, you can kind of read backwards and say, okay, this movie is a dramatization of these ideas that all kind of exist and are expounded upon throughout the movie, as we've said, sort of unsubtly. So I think that's cool to me, just to admit, like, here's the idea set, and to at some point just open that up.
It also gives the audience as a book homework,
recommendation,
right?
Is very funny.
Right, like,
right. Yeah, it's like this movie is a reading list, and the reading list is this one book. So I mean, that's kind of cool. So I liked it, but exactly, yeah, Zazie Beetz is a insane speed reader.
It's also, well, as my friend Sean said on Twitter, perhaps it was like a shampoo day, so he was taking extra long time, like, you know, working it into the edges of ends of his hair. Also, you know, one of the things that made that sort of spiky to me was like, it was like a step below Message, you know, like, yeah, at the end of a Spike Lee movie. But it was like basically the same thing, but it was like, it was a little more show don't tell, but it was sort of the same thing, right?
Right.
Yeah, Harry Edwards was the guy behind the Olympic Project for Human Rights, the architect of the protests at the 68 Olympics with John Carlos and Tommy Smith, has been a really hugely important figure in sports and civil rights for the last 50 years, and probably is not that widely known a figure outside of people who specifically study this stuff. And so it felt extremely like self-conscious as far as like, you should know, you audience member should know who this person is. You should look, you should look at this book. And yeah, it's like, I think for me, I'm more of a show don't tell kind of guy in life, but this was a movie that has no interest in being subtle. So it was certainly true to itself. And I'm not mad at like trying to get people to know and appreciate and understand what Harry Edwards is about.
Right. Absolutely.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep. While you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The opening weekend of the opening season of the Alliance of American Football began with victories for the San Antonio Commanders, Orlando Apollos, Birmingham Iron, and Arizona Hotshots over the San Diego Fleet, Atlanta Legends, Memphis Express, and Salt Lake Stallions. The one thing we should all agree on here is that these team names sound like they're from an unlicensed 8-bit video game.
That's right. It's like Tecmo Bowl, but not, yeah, like the off-brand Tecmo Bowl.
Right.
Other takeaways from this first set of games include that former Jets draftee Christian Hackenberg is still not a pro quality quarterback, no matter what level of pro football we're talking about. He also had a hard time remembering that he was mic'd up, if we can hear a little bit of that.
Here they come, third and long, and they get the job done again.
How the fuck did he hit it? Speaking of being mic'd up, the AAF broadcast includes chatter from the replay booth, which is admirably transparent.
Okay, so what's the ruling on the field? It was a catch, correct?
So he's out.
Okay, so well, here's what I've got. I've got only 1 foot in plus loss of control, so we are going to go incomplete pass on this play.
I could see that coming to the NFL, maybe.
Maybe.
Gene, let's start with the overall proposition here. As opposed to the USFL, the XFL, the AAF wants to work with the NFL rather than against it. It sees itself as filling a niche, that niche being let's be football on television when there's no other football on television. What do you think of that idea? And do you think this league has a chance to succeed where others have failed?
I mean, it seems like if those two other leagues, well, not those aren't the only ones, but if they failed in a climate that was much more, I think, much less fraught for football, then like I can't understand what the long-term prospects are for the AAF, right? I mean, like people are really thinking about football in a very different way now, like much more critical of it. It's a much more fraught fandom. And even still, football is like this like saturated market, right? I mean, like we still have, I mean, there's no football on right now.
Exactly. Now you're getting it.
But like how much football can this country, like can like networks bear? It seems so weird. Like, you know, the ratings sort of rebounded for the NFL this year after being down last year. You know, it was all the, is it the protests? They sort of rebounded this year. But it doesn't seem like the long-term trend line for the NFL is that you should be that optimistic about it, that people should also be like, we can also then have a totally separate league with lower quality play running at a time when no one else is, you know, when neither college football or the NFL are happening.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me would be if they went all the way and like made their league like alt football. That to me is the void. Like people that don't want to watch football for these reasons. Yes, like the one slide pitch is like there's no football on right now. But there's like it would be so much more interesting if it was like, you know, cruelty free football. Like all the things that we talk about with football, like about the helmets, like they need to be different, or like the hits need to be drastic, whatever it is that we talk about, like it, the football that people would be fine letting their, you know, little league son play or whatever. Somebody should make a pro league like that. That's just like super fast because nobody's, league. Yeah.
So yeah. I think maybe that niche is already taken. Like the big maybe, highlight maybe. From the weekend was there was a defensive player, Sean Washington, sacked. Right. Quarterback Mike Berkovicki and his helmet popped off like Rock'em Sock'em like Robots.
Terrible. It was horrible, yeah.
So maybe they'll lean into that, like decapitation is what we'll go for.
Even worse football.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. It also made me wonder too, what's the difference in the gap, right, between second tier football and second tier other sports? I was watching Duke Virginia the other day, and like, sure, Zion did some amazing things in that game, but there were just lots of bank shots. There were too many bank shots that did not seem like they were on purpose. Like, it just like, it was so far. And I don't know if like, you know, whenever the G League becomes, you know, televisable, maybe we'll get to test that proposition. But it's like, this kind of just looked like football to me in a way that second tier basketball is immediately so much worse.
Huh,
this was just football, so maybe, you know, maybe that's fine. And to all they need is the one slide that says, you know, how about March? You know, and that's the only thing about it. And like, maybe that's what makes it fine because it just looks like football.
It looks like
with bootleg names.
So you're saying it looks more like plausibly like passable professional football than like
right.
preseason NFL football does.
I don't think that's true. Do you think that's true? That second tier football is more clearly football than second tier basketball is clearly basketball, Gene?
I don't. And one of the things about the second tierness of football is that, like, I think the NFL is actually really bad at evaluating talent, right? I mean,
sure.
And so, like, the actual sort of like objective gap in ability between somebody who might like have washed out of the league, or because they're on a bad team or like bad situation, and somebody who's like a starter for 4 or 5 years is like what does that even mean? You know what I mean? Like how many first round picks like wash out? I mean, or not in the league in 3 or 4 years? You know what I mean? Like it's just there's talent out there, or what people assume is talent. You know, that's like floating out there. I think it probably could be more passable.
The issue is so with Kaepernick just perpetually not getting signed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
By any teams, the scandal there was that the guys who were getting signed were really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Other than Kaepernick, I don't feel like there's a lot of freely floating available quarterback talent,
right?
But
running back talent or line talent. I mean,
sure, but so much of the quality of our perception of a football game being good is dependent on quarterback play. And like Michael David Smith of Pro Football Talk said, the quality of play is comparable to the second halves of preseason games with players who look like they're about good enough to be on NFL practice squads. So take that for what it's worth. I mean, on the business.
Maybe my football talent eye just isn't as good as it is for basketball. Maybe that's what it is. Because it just like, to me, it was like, okay, football.
What was the highest scoring game over this weekend?
Orlando scored like 40 points, and they ran the Philly special.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
He's got more
behind,
plays.
Behind Steve Spurrier. I mean, the biggest stars in this league are the coaches. Spurrier among them. But from the business side, the league was started by Charlie Ebersol, whose father, Dick Ebersol, was one of the minds behind the XFL. He has come into this not wanting to make the same mistakes as the XFL. And I think that...
Which constellation of mistakes is he talking about?
That's a fair point. But I do feel like this is not obviously going to fail, which is like a bar that most of these leagues fail to clear. And the XFL did have some innovations that percolated into the league, particularly around the way that games are filmed. Skycam, players being mic'd up. And there are rules in the AF that do feel like they could make their way into the NFL. We listen to the replay booth. We have not yet talked about, but there aren't extra points in this league. There are no onside kicks. And instead, if a team is trailing at the end of the game, they can do a 4th-and-12 play from their own 28-yard line to retain possession.
I think that's a great rule. The onside kick is just cool. How many times has the onside kick ever recovered? It feels so desperate and so, whatever.
So it's cool that they're trying different stuff. It doesn't seem, other than the team names, like it's too gimmicky. Trent Richardson is involved. It's like nice to see that he's still got a job. Like that gives me like a warm and fuzzy feeling. So I guess I'm in a wait and see mode, but I don't feel like it's inevitable that this is going to fail. I guess let me revise. I think that back to the original point about football and where we're at with the game. Fandom of football, if you like know and care about head injuries and the toll that it takes, is irrational. And I think a lot of what that irrationality comes from is fandom. Mm-hmm. My fandom of the Saints, my fandom of LSU. Mm-hmm. It feels, this is a cop-out, and I will admit as such, but it feels like in some ways it's out of my control. It's like, what could I do? I was born to root for the Saints and LSU. But like, it is definitely in my control whether I root for the San Diego Fleet. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I think is missing from this league is trying to build up a football league from nothing with teams that have no fans seems particularly fraught at this point.
Or it's like astroturfing, right? No pun intended, I guess. But it's like this astroturfing of football fandom, right? We all get sort of grandfathered into these fandoms, right? Because, I mean, it's football more than the other professional sports is especially about the teams, right? I mean, because the players are in a lot of ways really anonymous. They're interchangeable. I mean, there's so much turnover from season to season. Like, fandom, outside of, like, your superstar quarterbacks, maybe your superstar wide receivers, most people don't, couldn't pick their favorite players out of a lineup, you know? Like, if they were just walking out. If they couldn't pick their favorite players out of a lineup. And so these teams won't be able to rely even on, like, if there are sort of some quasi-name players like Trent Richardson on the team, even that won't be enough, right? Like, you sort of need the social momentum of fandom to make the San Diego Fleet plausible.
Well, it just seems like a really bad idea to put teams in existing markets. Like, maybe it's true that San Antonio and Birmingham are really starved for professional football. Like,
they're
I can see that
football, like, you know, those they're football crazy places, right?
Yeah, Alabama, I can see that making sense. But putting teams in San Diego and Atlanta, only 2 of the 8 franchises are in NFL cities, but that just makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. That seems like asking for, then you'd terrible. Actually have, to your point, like you would actually be able to compare what top flight football talent, football play looks like versus, you know, I mean, it would be really, really appreciable. I mean, you know, Vincent is in New York, so he doesn't, maybe that's why he can't tell the difference between practice squad play.
I've been watching the Jets. It's all the same to me.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Now it is time for After Balls, and I am going to do an After Ball, and I will force Gene and Vincent to listen to me as I deliver what might sound like a hot take, but I can assure you that it's not. But before I do that, I wanted to give our After Ball name for the week. And Gene, on Twitter, your username is Deadlift Shrimp, which is one of the all-time great Twitter puns.
I
wanted to ask, did you know that when Deadlift Shrimp was playing for the University of Washington in the 1980s, the coach at rival Oregon nicknamed him White Magic because of his failure to trade for Anthony Davis? No, because of his versatile all-court game.
White Magic. He was like 6'9", had like a little bit of floor game, could shoot a bit. Well, Magic couldn't shoot, but yeah.
It will be a real milestone in this country when we have a black Deadlift and not just a White Magic. But for now, let us celebrate White Magic. Okay, here's my hot take. And I'm going to try to convince you that it is less hot than it seems. And that is that Zion Williamson is going to be the number one pick in the draft. He's having a truly astounding season at Duke. One of the greatest athletes ever to play basketball. I think the best comparison for him is Julius Randle.
What? Okay.
Julius Randle.
This is a very hot take.
Of the New Orleans Pelicans.
Wow.
So Zion is shooting 68% from the field, which is insane. Vincent watched him on television. That's how good he is. But, the level of hype for him is getting out of control. He's averaging 22 points a game, 9 rebounds, 2 steals, 2 blocks, a couple plays every game where you cannot believe what you just saw. Julius Randle, by contrast, got renounced by the Lakers last offseason in one of their not stronger personnel moves, but they just wanted to free up more money to sign LeBron, who you might recall is the guy who was Zion Williamson before there was a Zion Williamson. Mm-hmm. But Julius Randle is not just a guy the Lakers dumped. He was the number two player in the country coming out of high school in 2013, just like Zion is the number two player in the country coming out of high school in 2018, consensus, after his Duke teammate RJ Barrett, although we might shift those rankings around a little bit now that we've seen a few more data points. And Randle's numbers, they weren't as good as Williamson's in college, but he did lead Kentucky to the national title game. He's also left-handed like Zion, and he's huge. He's 6'9", 250, compared to Zion is like 6'7", and 800 pounds, or whatever he is, 6'7", 285. But Randle's really powerful. He's really fast. He can take guys off the dribble. And my guy, Julius Randle, is just 24 years old. He is putting up huge numbers this year. Well, nobody's paying attention. He's scoring 20 and grabbing 9 rebounds in 29 minutes a game. So what I'm saying,
is he?
He is.
It's crazy.
Wow.
Backing up. So he's the backup on the Pelicans, right?
Yeah, he's 6th man.
Wow.
I mean, he'll probably play more now that Anthony Davis is playing like 25 minutes a game. So what I'm trying to say here is that nobody in basketball plays more like Zion Williamson than Julius Randle. And Julius Randle is showing that you can have a lot of success in the NBA playing like Julius Randle. And that if Zion Williamson had the same amount of success as Julius Randle, he'd be averaging 20 and 10, which is not a bad thing to average. So I just want to say congratulations to Zion Williamson for earning the Julius Randle comp. And fingers crossed that one day he'll be as good as the guy Lakers renounced so that they could pay LeBron. The other way that you could interpret what I just said is that maybe there's nobody you can compare to Zion Williamson. And if Julius Randle is the best comparison, then that's saying that maybe you're incomparable. But I also just wanted to tell people that Julius Randle's having a good season. Right? Somebody needed
good.
To say it.
You had to do some log rolling for the Pelicans.
That was a real service.
Thank you for not laughing. Well, you did kind of laugh.
We actually did laugh.
Thank you a little bit. Thank you for not laughing louder. That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. Gene Demby, thank you for being here.
Appreciate you, man. Thank you for having me.
Vincent Cunningham, thank you.
So much fun.
To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmu Beatty and thanks for listening.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.